Greetings and welcome to the Cathartic Yardstick with your hosts, Ray and Mark. There's a saying that if you can remember the 1960s, you probably weren't there. Well, your intrepid hosts are going to test that theory by sitting down with my brother Mike to talk about his recollection of the 1960s music scene and the British invasion. He's a Renaissance man, and not just because he's got smallpox. So turn on, tune in, and drop out. Buckle up, as seatbelts are brand new as we head back to take a look at the Swinging 60s Music Edition.
Welcome to the Cathartic Yardstick Podcast, coming to you from the nation's capital and the world's capital. We have another podcast lounge session today. Mike and I are in the podcast lounge in New York, and Mark is down in Virginia. And Mike is experiencing the phenomena I often experience, that Mark is in his head today, rather than here, personally.
You are so lucky.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's not just me today. It's a shared delusion.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, number one, I wanted to thank Mike for taking time to appear on our humble podcast.
My honor.
I know because, you know, I've been with this guy for most of my life. I've known him as my brother.
And so, what, Ray or oh.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you. Yeah, you. Yeah. I've known you most of my life.
Most of them.
Yeah. So you're older than me. So
just change your diapers, pal.
And if you hang on long enough, you'll have the chance again. Should happen any moment now.
Mark, but anyways, let's return the favor.
That's right.
Oh, that's right. Does wonder.
You can imagine what used to happen when Mom said, "You know, I used to kiss that little bottom," and I said, "Well, if you want a trip down memory lane." So, oh, you get out of here! You take the pioche. Anyways, I can remember talking with Mike. The British invasion hit when Mike was in high school, and so he's the one that brought this stuff home. And God bless him, it's one of the biggest favors he ever did for me, because it kind of gave me a start into popular music when it was happening, which was absolutely great. So very much appreciate you taking the time to stop by.
Well, it's going to be fun.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of set the stage and kind of keep the conversation moving forward. But as I see it, in the 50s and 60s, it was a real revolution in popular music. There was a rise of different genres of rock, as well as a lot of experimentation and the fusion of those various genres. And so what I was going to do is sort of walk through the different genres as I see them. We'll talk a little bit about it. And if I say something which gives you a profound thought, feel free to wade in. But anyhow, late 50s, early 60s, I kind of see it as the continuation of the pop and rock and roll trends of the 1950s. You had Elvis, Bobby Rydell, Dion, Everly Brothers, The Ventures, doo-wop groups. And in the background, folk really was the rage. It was skiffle in the United Kingdom. And that's a theme that's going to keep coming up, because I kind of see the folk thread is kind of weaving through this whole story and eventually developing into the foundation of the singer-songwriter era in the 70s. But anyhow, so as we're in the late 50s, early 60s, we'll start with subcategories, you know, mainstream pop. You had the arrival of Buddy Holly, which I kind of view as a chronological phenomenon of the late 50s. He appeared and disappeared. But his presence really was mostly, began to be felt really in the 60s. What are your recollections of Buddy Holly coming into the music scene? What were people talking about? And what do you think was different about his music?
I remember so vividly, but it was mainly because of Lee, our older sister, who's 6 years older than I, and that was an enormous difference at that age. So like in 58, I would have been 10, she'd be 16, so it caught her square in the forehead. But I'd watch American Bandstand. I have memories of rushing back from St. Marie's School. You know, we're walking back and having Rich Arometta would be walking with, saying, "What's the hurry?" And say, "I have to go and watch American Bandstand." He'd say, "What's that?" And I would look at him like a dog does when you try to talk to it, you know, with my head cocking from side to side. How can you not know? But anyway, so that's why I was even paying attention. But I was already playing guitar, trying to teach myself. So music was very alive to me. And Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly, I didn't quite get. I liked it. I remember the songs. That'll Be the Day. The Crickets on the flip side was Every Day, I think. I was on the flip side of that. I still remember the record, you know, label. But what I saw was the instrumentation, probably because I was a guitar player. But it was like drums, guitar, you know, bass. And that became the musical cell of popular music as it unfolded. But it was great, and I couldn't quite latch on to the rockabilly thing, the skip in his voice, and it just seemed so foreign to me. It had a big influence on me, Buddy Holly, and most of it, I got to say, I encountered it retrospectively because I just sort of went down the folk path, which I know you're not talking about now, but Buddy Holly was sort of like hung on an external level of my awareness for quite a while, probably till the Beatles. And then I could see the derivative, you know, nature of it. But I liked the songs. I sure did. He could write.
If I could interject something, I don't know if either of you saw the movie Inside Llewyn Davis. Coen Brothers movie?
No, I did not.
It was a good movie. It's about a folk singer, kind of at the end of the folk period, beginning of the singer songwriter, and the very last scene is him running into Dylan in a club, which is kind of like starting that whole new era. And Dylan would eventually bridge the folk to singer songwriter to rock.
Yes, he did do that.
Yeah.
Plugged in at Newport in '65.
Yeah. Got booed.
Got booed a lot.
For the purists out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want your folkies plugging in.
I remember it was huge, him plugging in.
So 1959, you have the big plane crash that takes out Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, Big Bopper. Mm. What do you remember of that? Do you remember that being Big Talk or just on the periphery?
Big Talk. I mean, certainly not in my world at the time. In elementary school, where no one knew any of this was happening. It was only because of Lee, our sister. So I heard about it through her, and I remember her being shocked and upset. And I knew the Big Bopper, of course. I knew all of these people. But I mainly was, you know, watching her reactions to things, being... You know, the older sister, it just seemed too remote to me emotionally, but not to her. I remember that. So it kind of was shocking. Death is remote, you know, hopefully it's remote for people when you're that. It was for me at that age. Death at a young age was all the more remote.
Well, moving more into your musical evolution too, you get into the early '60s, and you're getting now on the verge of the British invasion. Mm-hmm. So the interesting background here, as I see it, you know, you set the context when "I Want to Hold Your Hand," the Beatles came out with "I Want to Hold Your Hand." When that entered the charts, the number one song that week was Bobby Vinton's "There I've Said It Again." "Louie Louie" by the Kingsmen and "Surfin' Bird" by the Trashmen.
There's right a lot of room, a lot of room for the Beatles to
We're number two and number five, respectively. The Beatles entered at number 45 with "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and at number 46, the Beach Boys' "Be True to Your School" was on its way down the charts after peaking at number 10.
You really did your homework here.
So in that milieu, you know, "I Want to Hold Your Hand" was really a sound revolution. So what you were in high school. So, I mean, what's your recollection of the hubbub about the Beatles and them arriving in America and showing up on Ed Sullivan?
Yikes. It was so It's so vivid. You know how everything seems close up when you're young? Smells,
yeah.
Everything. I mean, that's where I would have to put that. I was already, although, you know, I was into sports, and I really was into sports a lot. My real motive was that's how you meet girls, right? I was prescient enough to know that this won't last long. I better learn how to play guitar better than I do already. So I really was into folk music, and they were, my goodness, you know, I wasn't paying attention to Bobby Vinton. You know, there I've said it again. It just wasn't on. I knew it was there on the radio, but it wasn't on my radar. I was listening to just the folk people, you know, of the time. Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I was playing their stuff, you know, in my bedroom with the door closed. That's what I did. But I remember so vividly, I remember where I was standing when I asked this other basketball player, Larry Thomas. I asked him, what is this Beatles thing? And I remember him saying, oh, yeah, I know them. And he started singing something, you know, by it. And I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand that day, and I just knew I never heard anything like that. It was utterly new to me, and it spoke to me. It just put another part in my hair, back when that was physically possible and not mechanically ridiculous as it would be now. But yeah, no, it was. It's a very vivid recollection, like finding out, you know, the old, on the opposite, you know, side of the spectrum of good things, bad things. Where were you when you heard Kennedy was assassinated? I mean, it's a very vivid thing. Well, it's the same thing here, only on the positive end. It was like a door had opened, or a turn had been made. It was that song, and then everything just exploded from there. I remember, and you know, listening to the album. I still remember with whom, and we'll bore you with the names, that we'd listen to the record over and over and over and over. It just, I don't know. Even though I couldn't relate to the music in terms of as a player at all, it was now, and it was happening, and it was my world all of a sudden.
I can remember, and you know, this goes way back for me, because I was all of just about ready to turn 5, but believe it or not, I've actually got memories of it. As I recall, you came home basically saying, we've really got to check out Ed Sullivan.
Yes.
On Sunday night, because everybody's talking about this group that has like unimaginably long hair.
Isn't that funny?
I can remember they came on, and talk about, you know, just getting gobsmacked. I mean, it was like getting hit by a 2x4. Mm-hmm. But it was just the conjunction of, I have never heard anything like this, at the same time as, I've never seen anything like this. It was a visual and sonic phenomenon. It was a media and cultural phenomenon.
Right.
But, you know, I can remember looking at their hair saying, I had no idea a male's hair could grow that long. When you saw them on TV, were you bowled over by how powerful the presentation was?
Yeah.
As well?
Yeah, and it's really like you say, it was the sonic visual shock and yet, exciting. It was, yeah, I don't, and I, you know, I looking back on it, I don't know why. I mean, what you talk about, their hair being unimaginably long, I recall that, and the shock of it all. However, you know, look, first of all, one, it wasn't that long. Two, they were in suits, man. But it was a shocker for them as well, I guess is my point. But it sure spoke to me.
Were they the first group with a strong brand? I mean, they kind of invented branding in the music industry,
well,
didn't they?
Well, in pop music, yeah. But like I said, I came from I so much was entrenched in the folk thing at the time that I had like a musical identity as much as a teenager can have a musical. Right. Well, they were teenagers. What am I talking about? Yeah, I had a musical identity. I wasn't known quite as well as they were, however. Mm-hmm. I was by far the best guitar player in my bedroom, let me tell you that right now.
There you go. Interesting question, Ray, because I mean, I'm not sure with other groups, but just having followed the Beatles, I know there was a big, even visual presentation of their logo with the drop T, the oversized B. And the Ludwig, the oversized Ludwig, Ludwig wanted to make sure they made their logo like four times its normal size to appear on Sullivan.
Yeah, it was all very carefully marketed.
Right, everybody's buying Gretsch Country
I'd
Gentlemen's.
I've seen this before, like in the Kingston Trio, you know, the striped short sleeve shirts and the banjo and Peter, Paul, and Mary, the fancy handwriting, and the two guys like bookends with goatees. And the pressed blonde hair. I mean, a lot of marketing, a lot of branding, you know, there. So I guess that didn't jump out at me as that remarkable. And right down to the instruments in folk music, they all played Martin D28s, and so I knew that.
So that was the beginning of the British invasion. So what did you and your friends make of this whole British invasion thing? I mean, you had the Stones, the Dave Clark Five, the Animals, the Hollies, the Kinks, the Yardbirds. My perception was that Needles and Pins, right? My Love Potion Number 9. My gosh, my impression was that anybody who could remotely play an instrument broke through Britain, and it was only when you got down to Herman's Hermits and Freddie and the Dreamers that people were saying, all right, maybe this vein has been just about mined out.
Freddie and the Dreamers.
If you've seen Freddie and the Dreamers, they had a dance they used to do during their number called Do the Freddie.
They throw their legs out to the side.
This weird kick. I mean, it was just bizarre. Go to YouTube and look up Freddie and the Dreamers. Freddie.
I'm Telling You Now, is that the song?
I'm Telling You, yes.
Is that what they did? I think they did that dance in that song.
Yeah.
And he'd break out in this hysterical laugh.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like this Jerry Lewis on LSD kind of thing. were people, everybody was into everything British? Because, I mean, it was also the whole James Bond thing was hitting.
Yep. We had, you know, kids walking around school doing British accents, and it just, everything British, yeah, that became it, you know. And the sense that I had, I'm not going to speak for my entire generation now, although I could, no. The sense I had was, they can't all be good. It's impossible. They can't all be, they're just copycats, you know. But time has proven me wrong. Some of those bands were great. The Animals were, Jesus, they were probably one of the two most underrated bands of that era, the other being the Rascals, but it's not British. But yeah, the British was the thing. Wow.
So what were your most musically influential groups of the 60s and why? I know we're getting into folk now, but...
I have my first, this is like the musical equivalent, you know, of like an earthquake happened to me. I went with my squeeze du jour, whose name was Sue Martin. I won't mention her name, but she wanted to see this band at Siena. I was a freshman. And by this time, I want you to know, I was a serious guitar player. You know, but I'd played out, so, you know, I had such an attitude, as all folkies did anyway, because we played serious music about serious themes, not this rock and roll crap. Honestly, that's how I looked at it. So she wanted to go see this band called The Young Rascals at Siena, Gibbons Hall, in the gym, second row. So I really like Sue a lot, you know, so I figured I'll go with her. My expectations, I mean... I just wanted her to hear me play, you know, because then she'd hear a real musician. They came out, oh God, you know, it was like this thing about in acting, like taking stage, where you just own it. As soon as they didn't even have to do anything, and I was pressed at the back of my chair. But I'll never forget, love is a beautiful thing. All I could see was Gene, and I still remember. If I ever played a seventh chord, it died of loneliness. Okay? But I remember F major 7, G minor 7, F major, G minor 7, F minor 7. I mean, all in the first position, and I never heard anything like that before in my life, and it changed everything. They were incredible. All right, I'm done with that one now. I had to get that out there. The Rascals, they were incredible.
Yeah, do you remember other groups you saw at that time that were big in the charts?
Right, that was like my first big... Well, I had never seen a rock and roll band. I saw the Intruders, a high school band from Scotia High. I mean, they were kids. I'm not going to put them down, but they were kids, and I thought that's what a rock and roll band sounded like. And I didn't make the connection that what you hear in the recording, these are actually real bands, you know? And so I was just an open place for this to happen. No memories. And then the Rascals. And then the next year I saw the Association at the Washington Avenue Armory. And it had that same effect on me. I never knew people could sing like that, you know? Real pros. I mean, whoever wrote the charts obviously probably was no more than a glee club director, because all the parts were arranged that way, but it was great and they could play.
Well, before I get out of pop, and this is where I'm spending the bulk of my time, because it is what interests me, and it's all about me at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. As everything is, sure.
No, as everything is.
Wait, it's, I thought it was me. He made me.
Oh.
Oh.
No. Oh, sorry. Me. But anyways, in terms of the media that was out in the early 60s, let's take a look. I'll mention the Beatles one more time, only because they were the gold standard, really. Look at the environment through which they broke through. They were a musical, cultural, media phenomenon. I think people presume they just broke, and they broke huge immediately, and they had an easy time of it. But it sure didn't start out that way. It was an era in which there were limited outlets for music. There were only three TV networks, four if you counted PBS. Bands could only really break through by getting radio airplay, which would in turn sell records if your label was good at distribution. So back then, you had to win over individual disc jockeys that were not only local personalities, but they also made their own programming decisions. There weren't corporate playlists yet. And British bands had a history of not doing well in the U.S., so at first, record companies didn't really pay attention to the Beatles.
Interesting.
So as a result, it meant that the Beatles unintentionally had an opportunity to build up a huge following in the UK, mm-hmm. and a backlog of material, both musical and public relations. So in the UK, Please Please Me came out in March of 63, so an album full of material. With the Beatles came out at the end of November in 63.
God, 63, holy man.
Yeah, and it's interesting, EMI offered U.S. distribution rights to the Beatles records to their American subsidiary, Capitol Records, in 1962, but Capitol knew British groups don't go anywhere in the U.S., and so they declined. So what EMI did was they entered into a five-year agreement with VJ Records. It was a small independent R&B label based in Chicago. So the first Beatles single released by VJ in the U.S. was Please Please Me. That was February of 63, but it got very little promotion, very little airplay. It only sold about 5,600 copies. VJ followed up by releasing From Me to You in May of 63, but it never got above 116 on the Billboard charts. VJ ultimately ran into problems with royalty payments, so EMI canceled their distribution rights in the U.S., so they went back to Capitol and offered them the next Beatles single, She Loves You. But Capitol, whoa, being savvy, basically said, no freaking way, man. So they licensed the record to Swan Records, which was a small Philadelphia label. It was released in September of 63, but again, it got no promotion, no airplay. So it was only when Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, accidentally, he was on tour with the Beatles, they happened to run into Ed Sullivan at, like, Heathrow. And Ed Sullivan pulls him aside and says, I want to have you guys on the show. Would you be interested? And they talked and made a three-show deal, three consecutive Sundays they'd show up. And that was the thing that made Capitol say, okay, we're going to take a chance. These guys are going to get so much promotion. They got to sell something. So we'll release I Want to Hold Your Hand. But this time, the hand of fate came in, and the single ended up selling 1.5 million copies in under 3 weeks. And that was in January of 64. And it was another 30 days when this thing was all the fever that they then appeared, and they had a backlog, and that's why it was the tidal wave.
Boy, Mark, that's interesting. Jeez.
So, anyways, because that's the story that's never told, mm-hmm. what I think is so interesting about that is with media as spread out as it is now, the internet, hundreds of cable and satellite channel podcasts, some of which even are more affordable, more formidable than the Cathartic Yardstick. Hard to believe.
No.
Do you think a group could ever break as big in today's fragmented media environment as the Beatles did in the 60s?
I can't imagine how. I really don't. The only thing that makes me hesitate is the reality of YouTube, and that I could go home and record something that could be seen all over the world. I mean,
that's right.
So you
don't
knows?
Need a label. You don't need a DJ.
I don't need any talent, which is good because I don't have any anyways.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You were talking before about, you know, the evolution of musical instruments and music, and, you know, starting with just a guitar and the folk scene, and then going to the standard, you know, drums, guitar, bass. I was watching something on PBS where they're talking about Pet Sounds and how revolutionary that was, because all of a sudden you're bringing in all sorts of stuff, digital effects, a multi-track recording, but that's evolved too. Speaking of YouTube, where you can just go in a cabin in the woods with a laptop and record a whole album.
Yeah.
You know, multi-track recording, digital effects.
Yeah, Pro Tools.
Pro Tools, Pro Tools. I can make myself sound like a good singer, you know, honestly. But, yeah, it's incredible. It really is amazing.
As a segue, you talk about Pet Sounds. If you ever want great entertainment, there's a clip on YouTube, and I think it's Good Vibrations, a video for Good Vibrations.
Yeah, with the section.
Yeah, but it shows Brian Wilson in the studio. So you bring in pros like, you know, Hal Blaine on drums. Mm-hmm. And everything on paper, Brian Wilson should be worshiping at the drum kit of Hal Blaine.
Yep.
But instead, you know, he's telling Hal, look, when you come in on this one, I want you to come in really strong. I want you to come in this way.
Yeah.
And Hal Blaine is staring at him.
I used to joke and say it took me until the 1980s to realize that my favorite three drummers were Hal Blaine.
That's right.
He plays on everybody's records. He's a great drummer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But so it's cool with the internet. You have immediate access to an audience, so you don't need a DJ. You don't need a record company. But there's so much noise product, you know, to break through. Mm-hmm. So I like to think that the potential is there, but it's really hard to dominate in such a divided media, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, who knows what the next sound will be. We couldn't have imagined or visioned, you know, the Beatles. And yet, looking back on it, it's all derivative. It's, you know, it's not that different, and yet it was. So going forward, what if something comes out that's not guitar-based? I mean, that'll be new. Everything's always been guitar-based, but it wasn't when Sinatra was the rage, and he was the rage. Bones and bow ties. I mean, women went nuts for that guy. So who knows what can happen again? Some guy records a song on YouTube, and the time is right, and it happens again. But I can't imagine how, Mark. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, good question.
It's all guitar-based until you run into Thomas Dolby. Science!
Science! Science! Yeah, with the availability of electronic music. I mean, and it's great stuff. I was only going to make the point of, what's the guy's name? Brain Freeze. He recorded, Paul Simon did an album with him called Smile. I don't even think he plays an instrument. He's just an electronics dude.
Brian Eno. Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite records. I mean, the textured sound, it's just great. So who knows? Who knows?
Brian Eno.
How'd you know about Brian Eno?
He has this amazing ambient music where he's just playing tape loops.
Yeah.
And they're literally, we're draped across the legs of chairs and stuff, just playing different tones at different intervals. And it's just this random generated sound that's gorgeous.
That's been going on in classical music. So much of late 20th century classical music is minimalism. Minimalism is simply these little musical cells that repeat. So, I mean, he was, listening to that. And, I mean, he's a real serious, creative guy.
Done an amazing job producing Talking Heads.
Oh, he was the producer of Talking Heads. Didn't know that.
And I've been a fan of his since Here Come the Warm Jets is one of his albums back in the 70s.
Huh.
What influence do you think, do you see, the folk music really having on everything that was going on in the 60s music scene?
Yeah, well, that's pretty real to me. I mean, the political dimension, which emerged, obviously, because of the war in Vietnam and the civil rights movement, you know, coincided with the folk rage. And it really was, certainly to me, but it also was, you know, commercially, because Peter Paul and Mary had, you know, hit songs. And then, but you're right about the difficulty to listen to the roots of this thing. I mean, you go back to Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie in the 30s and the 40s and the Weavers, the Almanac Singers. But they were very political. But I think it always, folk music always sort of owned that. And when there was a convergence in the 60s because of just the political nature of the times, folk music was perfect for that. It just took it. And so it became protest music. And that spilled over into the rock scene, you know, as well. And Mark, you mentioned Brian Epstein and how there was, you know, marketing genius involved. It was the same thing in folk music, though. I mean, how to convert, you know, you can't take Pete Seeger and make him into a matinee idol. You know, it just didn't work. Or the Weavers. It just didn't play. Songs of the Bituminous Coal Miners and about labor unions, you know, are just never going to make it. So what he did is he went to Greenwich Village and found, you know, Milt Oaken, that was the guy's name, went and found who was out there playing. He found a stand-up comedian, singer, good guitar player, Paul Stuckey, Peter Yarrow, another solo folk singer, and Mary Travers, and got the three of them together and said, you know, grow your goatees, and not you, Mary. and he basically gave him a lot of upfront money and got him an apartment. And I think it sent him to Florida, I think, and said, kind of, you know, don't come out until you are clean, clean, clean. You know, somebody's got to count time. It matters. Your harmonies have to be true. And you frame the endings and you don't, you know, none of this folk crap, you know. And basically that's what they did. And they came out, came back. It was a Bitter End, I think, or the Café Wa, one of those places. And that was the first Peter, Paul & Mary album. But that was a business decision, which, of course, they didn't demur because they were suddenly making money, which folk people didn't make. And then that's the way it stayed. But when it got political, that's when they told Milt to take a hike. And next thing you know, they're on the Mall with Martin Luther King and the I Have a Dream speech and... I mean, they got, like, trivialized, you know, sort of at the end of their careers. But back in those days, they were all edges, as folk music was. Tom Paxton and Phil Oakes and, you know, all my heroes from that time, everybody was very political. You had to be. To be on the coffee house circuit, you were political by definition. And I think that spilled over into rock.
Let me ask you this. I mean, if there was going to be an anti-Vietnam rally or Martin Luther King was going to be at the Mall, the one thing you can't imagine opening up for them would be Ohio Express saying, every time I try to prove I love you, 1, 2, 3, red light, it just wouldn't work. So what was it, do you think, about folk music that really made it the natural child?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was urbane, it was intellectual, it was associated with college. I mean, Pete Seeger, his family came from Means, New York City.
It was artsy.
Yeah, artsy. It was always that. I mean, Woody Guthrie was not, you know, intellectual, but he sang about serious subjects, and the Weavers certainly did. Blacklisted, I mean, so they it always owned, you know, that... era. It was perfect for it, and coffee houses were the perfect atmosphere for it, so it just stepped right into the vacuum. You know, rock and roll, though, I tell you, I mean, well, this is off the subject of your thing, because it more fast forwards it to the present. Rock and roll is has always been, was always an idiom with two themes. It was about getting high and getting laid. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast.
You can say anything you want. We have no sponsors, so it's safe.
I mean, it really was about that. That's it. Folk music was not. Folk music, nobody had sex. We just didn't. But that's what rock and roll was about. But it changed. It morphed. And if you look around now, look at Don Henley, and people like that, and you know, people just writing really dark, and it expanded the idiom. And the Beatles were, God, they were the pioneers of that. Eleanor Rigby off of Revolver, my God, what a dark song, but it's great, you know. So anyway, I'm all over the map here. I'll shut up.
No. It's consistent. I think not you being off the map. It's consistent with the topic. It's very in keeping.
Hey Ray, shut him up. Throw something.
Shut up.
No, I think it's interesting that we lived in an age where music changed so much. I think before that it didn't make these great leaps and these meshing of different styles.
And that's exactly, talk about prescient. My goodness, I mean, it really gets me exactly where I am here. But every decade has had its own popular music and its evolution of its own music scene. But I really think the '60s were fundamentally different. They were unique, a lot more intense, a lot more creative. And so, what do you think it was that caused the rise of all these different genres of music and the experimentation and the fusion of the genres? I mean, you know, the World War II generation had, you know, Glenn Miller, big band kind of stuff, but it wasn't the same.
No, by no means. I have no idea. I don't know. Just the everybody listening at the same time. So people in the South, could you listen to the Beatles? And their kids were, even though mom and dad were playing George Jones and Merle Haggard. And if you're on the West Coast, you know, the Beach Boys, but you... You know, the Beach Boys listen to the Beatles, so you got Pet Sounds, you get Sgt. Pepper, and, you know. So maybe everybody's listening. I don't know. But all it takes is someone to cross the line that's being drawn, and then you get fusion music. And that just, right, that just took off.
All I can think of is that, you know, you had a cultural revolution of going on between the really kind of repressed 50s, to the extent it was kind of buttoned down, to the more freeform 60s. People were getting disillusioned with government. Don't just trust it and go off to war. Start looking at whether it's a smart war before you start, you know, sending your sons off to fight in it. People are getting drafted. They're the ones getting sent off. And so they're fighting back. I mean, it's a very unique cultural environment. So I think that's got to be a big piece of it.
I think technology probably has a lot to do with it too. It kind of piggybacks on mass markets developing.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's sitting at home watching Ed Sullivan. So when the next big thing comes along, everyone's watching it. Everyone's there to see it.
That's right. Yeah. That's obvious. Yeah, it had obviously its tentacles, all over the place. But I really feel as though I lived in a privileged time.
That was amazing.
And I say that not only about music and having been a musician, like, you know, my whole life. What a time, you know, to be a guitar player. It's crazy. And what a time to be a folkie and then live through the civil rights movement. And it's just an amazing time.
Other than having Vietnam hanging over your head. That little buzzkill.
And it's one, so, two, three. Country Joe.
That's right. That's right, talking blues. So I think this is a real fitting way to kind of wrap up at least my part of the discussion about the 60s music scene. But today, December 8th, is the 38th anniversary of John Lennon's assassination. So do you remember where you were when you heard that he'd gotten shot?
Yeah. I mean, how can I forget? I mean, I was in Albany. I don't remember what I was doing there. I was, I remember exactly where, right across from the Capitol building, maybe like 100 yards down. And later there would be a big gathering there, people with candles. And yeah, I remember hearing it. Yeah, it was a stunner. I just shook my head in disbelief. It was just awful. Yeah.
In terms of how you felt about it, out of curiosity, did you find yourself a little surprised at how you felt about it?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting the way you should put that, because you're right. I'd forgotten that this guy was on the soundtrack of, you know, my life. That's what it felt like. I mean, I was 64, you know, when I first heard them, but that's a lot of time, and music meant a lot to me. It was my generation, and I'd been through a lot, you know. That's what it felt like, especially because he was the political one, and it spoke to me, and the anti-war thing and stuff, it felt very personal, and I was surprised at how profoundly I felt it. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it was actually very interesting because there was a probably 6, 7, 8 months before that. It was probably the summer of 1980 or the spring in 1980. I went with a friend of mine to the 8-Step Coffee House because they were showing Magical Mystery Tour at the 8-Step. I remember thinking at the time, it's really amazing, you know, you have all these rock stars die of drug overdoses and all these crazy self-destructive lifestyles, but I got all four Beatles still alive. And I remember thinking to myself, which Beatle being still alive surprises me the most? And I thought, probably Lennon, because he was the most with the rough edges. And then this happens in December, and I would imagine myself feeling bad that it happened to one of my musical idols. I would feel kind of deprived of what new music would he have come out with. Maybe disappointed that, oh gosh, now the Beatles reunion that would have happened someday in some form, now won't happen. And it was all that, but it was more. There was this sense of emptiness. It was like the 60s died.
Yeah.
It was just a weird feeling.
Yeah.
For me.
I can relate to that. And also, I mean, I don't know, you read all kinds of things into these people who are larger than life, and I knew that Travail's and Yoko and all that, but they were back together, and it was good, and it was inspiring, you know. And then to have it destroyed.
Right. Was like, he'd found himself.
Maybe stories don't end well, you know. Of course they don't. It's one of the admission tickets to the real world, is to recognize that things often don't end well. Sure. But I didn't want to know that at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know, I was still young enough, I wanted to believe. But yeah, it affected me that way, it did, you know.
Sometimes we don't need the rude awakening. We get enough of our own.
I know.
But how about you, Ray? Remember when you heard?
I was in our college apartment. I remember exactly where I was standing. The TV was by the front windows, and I was standing right behind the couch, and I just remember the news flash coming on, and it was just shocking.
Yeah. And how did it hit you? Did it hit you differently than you would have expected?
Yeah. Because it was more than just, he was more than just a celebrity. I mean, he was very much part of that whole fabric of the 60s and going on into the 70s and the war protests. And it's not like you ever thought of a world without him being there. Mm-hmm. You kind of just assume he'd always be around. Mm-hmm. And it was a shock.
That's it. That's a good point, yeah.
Of course, I'm sure that the thought you had first and foremost was, poor Mark, I wonder what he's going through.
Absolutely.
Did you think that? I didn't think that.
I think that all the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think that all the time.
But actually, a few years back, Michelle and I were walking around New York City at night, and we were walking over just to grab a hot dog someplace and walking up Central Park West. And we get to this intersection. There's this very eerie-looking, ominous building, and we walk by it, and we just got a chill. And then I realized it was the Dakota, and which is kind of a scary-looking building at night.
Mm. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, wrapping up the last question I really have, and it's really an open-ended question, and I'm not sure there's any ready answer for it. Granted, these are very odd times we live in. We're very much absorbed in the moment. These are very unique times, I think, in some ways. But think of the music and society we had in the 60s. Anything you see today, do you see reflective of influences that remain from 1960s music, culture, And if so, where do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like I'm being critical, saying things are derivative. You know, I'm not. Everything is derivative, obviously. God help me if something comes out that's entirely new, not connected to the past. But I do see the lines of connection musically. We had like, rock, jazz fusion that I know you're a fan of too, Mark. That happened in the 70s, and you listen to John Mayer, who's just a phenomenal guitar player, good God, and a great writer. But he comes, he was almost you could predict it, So you can name individual people, but it's still essentially a guitar-based, idiom. So, thank you, Buddy Holly. It does go back to that, and you're still going to have, bass, rhythm, guitar, drums, for the most part. So I think I'm going to sound just like our parents. But what's missing is the passion. Jesus, I mean, this music sustained me. I don't know how else to put it. That's true for me. 68, 69, those were 70. Those were not good years. But when I didn't have my guitar in my hands, the headphones were on. It was a desperate time. I felt it. I felt that way. And music sustained me, and that's not an overstatement. I don't see that happening today.
You've been listening to the Cathartic Yardstick Podcast. Join us again as we explore the meaning behind the meaning.